This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to listen back to an interview with the Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Frank McCourt. He died yesterday of metastatic melanoma. He was 78. McCourt spent most of his career teaching writing at Stuyvesant High School in New York. But in his 60s, he decided to write a memoir about his miserable childhood in the slums of Limerick, Ireland. That book, Angela's Ashes, became a surprise bestseller in 1996. It remained on the bestseller list for 2 years and won both a Pulitzer Prize for biography and a National Book Critics Circle Award. McCourt wrote two more memoirs, Tiz, about his early years in New York, and Teacher Man, about his experiences teaching. Angela's Ashes was adapted into a film. I spoke with McCourt in October 1996. I asked him first to read a passage from Angela's Ashes.
My father and mother should have stayed in New York, where they met and married and where I was born. Instead, they returned to Ireland when I was 4, my brother Malachy 3, the twins Oliver and Eugene, barely 1, and my sister Margaret, dead and gone. When I look back on my childhood, I wonder how I survived it all. It was, of course, a miserable childhood. The happy childhood is hardly worth your while. Worse than the ordinary miserable childhood is the miserable Irish childhood, and worse yet is the miserable Irish Catholic childhood. People everywhere brag and whimper about the woes of their early years, but nothing can compare with the Irish version. The poverty, the shiftless, loquacious, alcoholic father, the pious, defeated mother moaning by the fire, pompous priests, bullying schoolmasters, the English, and the terrible things they did to us for 800 long years. Above all, we were wet. Out in the Atlantic Ocean, great sheets of rain gathered to drift slowly up the River Shannon and settled forever in Limerick. The rain dampened the city from the Feast of the Circumcision to New Year's Eve. It created a cacophony of hacking coughs, bronchial rattles, asthmatic wheezes, consumptive croaks. It turned noses into fountains, lungs into bacterial sponges. It provoked cures galore. To ease the catarrh, you boiled onions in milk blackened with pepper. For the congested passages, you made a paste of boiled flour and nettles, wrapped it in a rag, and slapped it, sizzling, on the chest. From October to April, the walls of Limerick glistened with the damp. Clothes never dried. Tweed and woolen coats housed living things, sometimes sprouted mysterious vegetations. In pubs, steam rose from damp bodies and garments, to be inhaled with cigarette and pipe smoke, laced with the stale fumes of spilled stout and whiskey, and tinged with the odor of piss, wafting in from the outdoor jakes, where many a man puked up his week's wages. The rain drove us into the church, our refuge, our strength, our only dry place. At Mass, benediction, novenas, we huddled in great damp clumps, dozing through priest drone, while steam rose again from our clothes to mingle with the sweetness of incense, flowers, and candles. Limerick gained the reputation for piety, but we knew it was only the rain.
Frank McCourt, thanks for reading that excerpt. I want you to describe the house that you grew up in Limerick.
There were a number of houses. When we first arrived in Limerick, it was a one-room affair with most of it taken up with a bed. It was about a half acre of collapsing bed. And then the rest of it, there was a table, there were two chairs which my mother and father sat on. It was a fireplace, a small fireplace, with two little hobs where you placed, on which you placed the kettle. And there was in that particular house, there was a backyard and a lavatory. And we shared the bed with about a million fleas. But then we had to move out of there. One of the twins got sick and died there. So we moved to another place, another room similar to the first one, where another twin died. Oliver and Eugene were their names. Then we finally got out of there, and we went to a house called Roden Lane up in Barrack Hill near the soldiers' barracks. It was a house at the end of a lane. It was called Two Up, Two Down, that kind of house. Two rooms downstairs and two rooms upstairs. Except that these houses had no indoor plumbing and no backyard, so there was one lavatory for the whole lane, about 11 families sharing this one lavatory. And the lane sloped, So when it rained, a lake formed down at the end of the lane, and of course we were down at the end of the lane, and the lake of rain seeped under our door. We tried everything to keep it out. We used rags, everything, sods of grass. But the rain came in, and it was so damp downstairs that we moved upstairs. We called downstairs Ireland, and we moved up to Italy, which was warm upstairs. My mother said, this is like Italy up here, so warm and dry.
Here's a sense memory question. What do you remember the smells of your house as being?
Oh, there was a general smell of dampness. And I don't think we ever noticed that dreadful thing that's so feared in America called body odor. Because if we had, we'd all be dead by now. There was none of that. There was the lavatory when people emptied their buckets. Some families were worse than others. Now I'm going to get very gross and vulgar, but some families were worse than others with those buckets, especially if we had any kind of a warm summer. Then that lavatory was foul. That was the overriding smell all through the house, because we were unfortunate enough to have our front door at a right angle to that lavatory. That was the prevailing smell. And that eventually, I think, is where I got typhoid fever, from that lavatory.
And you spent, about 14 weeks in the hospital with typhoid
fever? Yeah. That was at the onset of my adolescence. And in a way, it was a gift. Because I discovered my first lines of Shakespeare, and I discovered the poem "The Highwayman," and books in general. I was given access to books.
In the hospital, you were expected to die. The priest came to give you extreme unction. Did you think you were going to die?
I didn't know at the time. I was so sick, I didn't give a damn whether I died or lived, I had no idea what was going on. I just knew. Somehow I was aware of the priest over in the corner saying Mass, and I knew that was significant. Something told me this was significant. And then he came over, and they pulled the sheets down, and they anointed me with the extreme unction oils. So I think I knew enough. We were good little Catholics. We were well-trained. I knew enough. I think the nurse told me, anyway, that it was going to be anointed.
Well, you were probably used to death. You had already had siblings who had died.
Well, we had people all over. Malachi and I, my brother, we used to go to funerals all the time. We belonged to the Death of the Month Club. A funeral was a great form of entertainment. A wake was a great form of entertainment. We'd wander around the streets. We had nothing else. So we were really street urchins. And we'd wander around the neighborhood looking to see if anybody had died. You could tell by a mourning wreath on the door, and which was pinned a purple bordered memorial card announcing the death and so on, R.I.P. at the end. And that was the signal for us to knock at the door and say, we were very sorry for your troubles, man, because there was tradition around that if children prayed for the dead, the dead were assured, guaranteed entrance to heaven. So we were guaranteed an entrance to the house to kneel by the bed and say a prayer for the deceased, because they were always kept in the house until they were taken to the church. There was no embalming, no funeral homes. So we'd kneel by the side of the bed, and when we were finished with our little prayers, we could go out to the kitchen, and they'd give us lemonade and biscuits, or lemonade and buns, and then we were sent home, unless it was a family we knew, and then we'd stay on for the wake, which went on all night, and then there was Guinness, and there was whiskey, and there was sherry for the women, and sometimes there was ham and bread, and we'd go around, even though we were only 6 or 7 years old, we'd go around creeping under tables and chairs, emptying the glasses, the jam jars, and the cups, or whatever was in it, sherry or whiskey or Guinness.
How did all the deaths that you were exposed to and the association between death and free food affect your feelings about death?
Well, we prospered. We didn't mind having somebody die in the neighborhood. If it wasn't our own family. But we got excited. We'd go to people's houses and knock on the door. Except one time, one of my friends, a kid named Clement O'Hanlon, died of TB, which we call the consumption. He had been in and out of the sanitarium, and he was a big fat kid who shrank away to nothing and then blew up again. And everybody said, well, that's the end of Clement. You know, when they blow up like that, that's the end. The healthier you look, the closer you were to the grave. in our lore, our local lore. So when Clement died, he shrank again. And we went to his house, and we went in to pray for him. And Mrs. O'Hanlon, his mother, was weeping and carrying on, she said. And there he was in the bed. He looked all yellow, and he looked like a little monkey. And I was frightened because that was not the Clement I recognized. And she says to me, "Kiss him, Frankie, kiss him. Kiss your poor little friend Clement." I said, "No, Mrs. O'Hanlon, it's all right. Come on, kiss him." And I was very reluctant, so she grabbed me under my shoulders, under the armpits, and pushed me against him and forced me to kiss him. And I'll never, as long as I live, forget the smell of Clement O'Hanlon in the bed, that cold, awful smell, that rot smell of rot that you only get from the dead.
When you discovered books and got deeper into them, I imagine you eventually read James Joyce's Portrait of the Artist.
Yeah.
And there's a scene similar to that in there where he has to kiss the body of his grandmother, is it?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you really relate to that when you read
no,
that?
No, I didn't remember. I think I put everything out of my head when I was writing the book. When I read Joyce, I related to all kinds of things, especially the religious stuff, which we all suffer from. There's nothing in the world like being an Irish Catholic. Nothing. I can't. I have Jewish friends who go on about the guilt and all that. They haven't the foggiest notion of what guilt is and fear and the rest of it. Because the difference between Judaism and Catholicism is, in Catholicism we have that grand institution called hell. And if you remember in Portrait of the Artist, hell is described very vividly. I've never come across anything like that in Jewish literature. The walls a million miles thick and the heat a million degrees and so on. And imagine being there a million, million, million years and so on. And devils chasing you with pitchforks ready to ram them up your behind. For eternity. Eternity, boys, eternity.
So do you think of your Irish Catholic childhood as being a particularly bad one because your family was so poor, or do you think of yourself as being typical?
Oh, I don't think it was. Well, we were poor, so but there was a lot of poverty around. And ours was desperate. I think on the hierarchy of poverty, we were at the absolute bottom. There was the added ingredient of my father's alcoholism. Which a lot of the families were poor, but they didn't have the alcohol disease that we suffer from, because he was uncertain. He was a crazy man when he drank. He just drank everything. So we had the Catholicism, the poverty, and my father's alcoholism. We were unique in the annals of poverty.
Your mother used to beg for money, borrow money, get money from charity, and then your father would accuse her of not having pride because she'd beg for money. On the other hand, he'd drink all the money she could have had legitimately. He'd drink that away. What did marriage seem like to you watching your parents?
It didn't seem like much because I had the couples that I knew, the married couples I knew, were always remote from each other. The husband from the wife and so on, because one of the paradoxical things, the stereotype of the Irish that you got, here we are a merry, mercurial, drinking, singing race. The fact is we were a bunch of Paddy Solemns. We were not demonstrative like the Italians. That's one race that I always admired when I came to New York, the Italians, for their gusto and their lust for life and the way they demonstrated their affections. Well, we didn't. You were not supposed to show any kind of love. I think it was a kind of weakness. You never saw men embracing each other. You never saw husbands kissing wives. I saw my father kissing my mother when he was leaving to go to England, and I was appalled. I thought it was like as if they were copulating right in front of me. Although it was all right to go to the Lyric Cinema. It was all right to go to the Lyric Cinema and see Clark Gable kissing people and so on. That was all right, but that's only on the film. And I thought, when I was 9 or 10, they weren't really kissing. What they do was got two films and put them together. They slice it and put them together somehow in the projector so that they weren't really kissing, because people wouldn't do that in public or for a camera.
Gee, it must have been hard for you when you came of age.
You have no idea. My innocence when I came to New York was formidable, epic, that I had to flounder along, because when I became a teacher in New York, I looked at the kids in my classes, high school kids at Stuyvesant High School, with their easy relationship back and forth. comparing myself with them when I was a teenager, and I was a pathetic character.
Well, you got out at the age of 19 in 1949.
Yeah.
Where'd you go?
Came to New York. That was the only place. This is where I was born, so I came back here, and I was on a ship, a freighter, called the Irish Oak. They had a small fleet of freighters then, the Irish. And we were supposed to set sail for our first destination was New York. Then they told us 2 days out we were going to Montreal. Then they changed that to New York again. Then they changed it again to Albany. And I was very peeved at that because I wanted to get off in New York City. So we sailed right into New York Harbor on a gorgeous October morning. And there was Ellis Island, the Statue of Liberty, and the skyline beyond. And I was in heaven. I had seen the skyline so many times in the movies and in books. I thought I was walking on air. I thought I was... All I had to do now was land in New York City and go dance down Fifth Avenue like Fred Astaire. And Ginger Rogers would be waiting for me in Washington Square. That's all I was going to do for the rest of my life. And music would play everywhere I went.
Well, did you hop off the freighter in Manhattan even though it was destined to go to Albany?
No, I didn't. Went right up to Albany.
Oh.
They wouldn't let us out.
So the skyline just passed you by.
Skyline passed me by, and we were all angry. But the ship had to dock because of the tide in the middle of the Hudson up near Poughkeepsie. And a man, well, this is in the books. I'm not going to say any more about it. A man came out in a little boat, a putt-putt, and took some of us ashore. We went to a party in Poughkeepsie. And my first night in America was heavenly. There was a party given by a group, four women whose husbands were away hunting. So they had us, me, and some of the ship's officers, and there was a wild night, thank God.
An antidote to the repression.
Yeah.
You made it to Manhattan, finally.
Finally, I took a train down, and I met a priest on the ship, and he helped me find a room, and he helped me find a job, and I wound up working in a hotel that's famous in American literature, the Biltmore Hotel, where John Cheever often has his characters meet under the clock, or Updike, or J.D. Salinger. There was that large clock then. All the Ivy League types would come into Grand Central on Thursdays, I think, mostly, or Fridays. To have the wild times in New York, you'd have those Harvard boys and Yale boys and girls from Radcliffe and Bryn Mawr and so on. All the golden people, I thought. And I would go around. My job was to clean up in the lobby with a dustpan and a broom and empty the ashtrays and so on. And I moved among them, feeling, feeling humiliated because these were these absolutely beautiful girls whose legs went on forever. And golden hair and so on. They're God's chosen. And I promised myself that someday I'd have one of them. And I did.
And?
Unfortunately.
Unfortunately, did you say?
Yeah.
Well, what do you say?
The Chinese said, be careful what you ask for, you might get it.
Right. Now, how'd you get from doing, you know, sweeping and cleaning jobs in Manhattan to teaching English at Stuyvesant High School in Manhattan?
I owe it all to Mao Zedong.
To who?
Mao Zedong.
Oh, Mao Zedong?
Yeah.
Oh, what did he do for you?
Well, there I was in the Biltmore Hotel cleaning up and so on. And miserable because I knew I was better than that I could do other jobs, that I could sit in an office or something like that. But I couldn't get anything because I didn't have a high school diploma, the sacred high school diploma. I left school when I was 13. Every time I went for a job, oh, no, you have to have the high school diploma. You have to have evidence that you had a high school diploma. So I waited and waited and waited, and then I toiled away with my broom and my dustpan in the Biltmore Hotel till the Chinese attacked Korea in 1951 or 1950, I think, and America got nervous and turned to me and drafted me. And even though there was a Korean War going on, they sent me to Germany. And I spent 2 years in Germany training German shepherds to be fierce. And then when I got out of the army after 2 years, I had a great time in Germany, in Bavaria. There was loads of beer and a surplus of women. So I had a great time. And when I got out of the army, I went to back to the meat. I worked in the docks for a while, and I worked in warehouses, merchants refrigerating and port warehouses and so on, unloading trucks. And after that, then one day I was living in the village in Downing Street, and I used to go to the White Horse bar and sit there in the afternoon before I went to work. I used to work the 4 to 12 shift. And I was having a knockwurst and a beer, and I said to myself, is this what you're going to do for the rest of your life? And I walked out of the White Horse. I didn't know where I was going, but you know the energy you get sometimes when you feel embattled. So I walked out on the sidewalk. I didn't know where I was going. Walked across the village, across Washington Square, and there was NYU. And this is pure serendipity. I walked in, and I looked for the admissions office. I applied. They laughed at the idea of me not having a high school diploma. But I told them I was literate, that I read books and things like that. So they admitted me on a year's probation, mainly because I was a veteran and I had the GI Bill. And I got my B average for a year, and then I was matriculated, and then three more years I was ready to teach high school in the schools of the city.
And did you retire thinking that you were going to write? Was that the reason you did it?
Oh, I always knew I was going to write. This is one of the things that turned me into a schizophrenic, practically. I liked the teaching. I loved it. I had some success some days. But I always wanted to write this book. For some reason, I had a responsibility to my family and to the people who lived around me. I felt that I had to convey their dignity of the people, the way they dealt with adversity and poverty and their good humor.
Now, you eventually brought some of your family over to America, didn't you?
They all came.
They all came.
Couldn't keep them away. I sent Maliki came after me. I was in the army when he arrived. Then he joined the Air Force. This was the best time of my mother's life. We were up to send her allotments from the government. So she was able to move to a new house in Limerick. She had clothes and food, two bedrooms and a sitting room and a kitchen and a backyard. So she was doing very nicely. Maliki came, then Mike came, then she came, my mother, with Alfie. So by 1960, we were all here.
How did your mother do in America?
She didn't do very well. I don't think she did. I think she would have been better off staying in Limerick. No matter how bad it is, I thought she was going to come over here and have one big happy family, but we were all getting married, and she didn't particularly care for any of the women that we married, because none of them, and she complained about this, not one of you married a nice Irish Catholic girl. There's nothing in this family but Jews and Protestants, Protestants and Jews. Every time I cross the floor, I'm tripping over little Jews and Protestants. And then the kids would come running to you. Dad, what was Nana doing to me in the middle of the night, pouring water all over my head? Baptizing everybody. So I think she was looking for one of us to marry a nice Irish Catholic girl, somebody that she'd have something in common with, and we never did.
So she was unhappy.
She was unhappy, yeah.
Have you ever gone back to Ireland?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I've gone back a number of times, but always with a chip on my shoulder, a feeling of anger. But I went back in May, and I was back there a few weeks ago with a German television crew, and I felt I got a lot of the stuff out of my system by writing the book, and I feel much more comfortable. As a matter of fact, I'm Ireland. Once you live there, you're seduced by it, by the climate and the weather, the hills, the streams, and everything else. I've always loved it. In addition to that, you have a sense of history. Everywhere you look, something happened there. Something significant happened in Irish history. And then I'm haunted by Limerick, because I go back there and every street corner reminds me of something. Every street reminds me of something.
Frank McCourt recorded in 1996 after the publication of his memoir, Angela's Ashes. He died yesterday at the age of 78. Ever since the news broke Friday evening that Walter Cronkite had died, journalists and TV critics have been paying tribute to him. Our TV critic, David Bianculli, would like to add his voice to those tributes and describe Cronkite's place in TV history. After that, we'll listen back to my 1993 interview with Cronkite.
There are two types of history to consider when trying to put CBS News anchor Walter Cronkite into context. There's the history of broadcast news, CBS News in particular. And there's history itself, especially the tumultuous 1960s. Anyone who was alive then, and old enough to care about current events, will remember when they heard the news that President John F. Kennedy was shot, or that man had landed on the moon. And in the United States, it was most likely that you heard that news from Walter Cronkite. He rose to prominence just as TV news itself did. In an age long before the existence of 24-hour cable news networks, broadcast TV was where people turned when news was breaking. And more than anywhere else, they turned to Walter Cronkite. CBS News has a history that is as simple as it is legendary. On radio, the concept of responsible news reporting was pretty much invented by Edward R. Murrow, who brought his excellence and passions to television in 1951 with See It Now. That was television's first true news magazine. But when CBS launched a 15-minute nightly newscast in 1948, Murrow didn't want to be bothered with it, so Douglas Edwards took the job. Walter Cronkite took over in 1962, expanded the newscast to 30 minutes, and was in place to cover many of the biggest news stories not only of the decade, but of the century. It was his voice you heard, for example, breaking into the daytime soap opera to deliver the first word of President Kennedy's shooting in Dallas.
And I gave it a great deal of thought, Grandpa.
Here is a bulletin from CBS News. In Dallas, Texas...
That was the very moment television became a grown-up. For much of the next several days, TV broadcast nonstop, acting like CNN decades before there was a CNN. People watched breathlessly as the suspected assassin was hunted and captured, and as he, Lee Harvey Oswald, was shot and killed on live TV while being transferred by authorities. TV broadcast Kennedy's funeral, too, and provided a communal way for the nation to mourn. Even Cronkite, as he delivered the news, got caught up by emotion at one point, removing his glasses and clearing his throat in a moment anyone who saw it surely remembers. Cronkite, explaining his feelings in a documentary profile, remembered it too.
Our man Dan Rather in Dallas reported that.
People asked me about my emotions during that day. Well, most of the day I didn't have keenly felt emotions.
For the assassin, a report has it that the man has been arrested, that he was operating from a second floor window.
The only time was actually when I had to announce that the president was dead officially, that we knew he was gone.
Dinner meeting there. From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago.
And I almost lost it there.
Vice President Lyndon Johnson has left the hospital.
In a decade filled with one major news event after another, two other Cronkite reports stand out in my memory, above all others. One was his 1968 documentary on Vietnam, when he took a trip and a camera crew to assess the status of the war. He came back persuaded that the best option was to withdraw with honor, and the power of his opinion and his platform was enough to mark a major political sea change. Here's Walter Cronkite in the conclusion of that documentary, then commenting on its impact years later.
For it seems now more certain than ever that the bloody experience of Vietnam is to end in a stalemate.
We heard that Lyndon Johnson heard this and said, well, if I've lost Cronkite, I've lost Middle America. And the next week he announced he wasn't going to run for re-election.
Then, in 1969, 40 years ago, there was Walter Cronkite's coverage of the Apollo 11 flight and the first manned moon landing in history. When the lunar lander touched down and astronaut Neil Armstrong descended the ladder in full view of a global TV audience, Walter Cronkite once again let his emotions get the better of him. But this time, those emotions were sheer joy, and he was beaming like a little kid.
Oh, boy. On the moon landing, I'd had just as long as the space program had to prepare for that landing. And Wally Schirra, the former astronaut who was my technical sidekick, kept asking me all morning, well, what are you going to say when they land? I said, well, I never plan these things, but I'll have plenty to say. turned out I was almost speechless for the first time in my life.
What?
We're going to be busy for a minute.
What did I say? Wow. Wow, golly, wow.
Wally, say something. I'm speechless.
I'm just trying to hold on to my breath.
Armstrong is on the moon. Yeah, Neil Armstrong, 38-year-old American, standing on the surface of the moon.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
I think I was as impressed with the television coverage as I was with the feat of getting a man on the moon.
Boy, look at those pictures.
Wow. I guess sometimes I'm a pessimist, but I really hadn't expected we were going to get that clear a picture from the moon. We were hoping we would. The technicians told us we were going to, but I was doubtful. And there it was, this great picture.
Look at that.
I think it was the first time we really knew of the extreme capabilities of television, that we could get a picture back from the moon, for heaven's sakes. I've decided if we could do that, we could do anything.
Walter Cronkite was forced to retire in 1981 when Dan Rather took over. With or without Connie Chung as co-anchor, Rather held the reins until the appointment of the current anchor, Katie Couric. And that's it, the entire history of the CBS Evening News, four solo anchors in more than 60 years. It's no disrespect to the others to say that Walter Cronkite was the best of them all. Or that, in terms of all of broadcast news history, Edward R. Murrow stands at the top, then Walter Cronkite, then everybody else. There will never be another Walter Cronkite. Because of the fragmentation of TV audience levels, there can't be. But when Walter Cronkite was the most viewed news anchor, he also was the most trusted, which is a proud legacy for any newsman to leave. And that's the way it is.
David Bianculli is TV critic for Fresh Air and TVWorthWatching.com. I spoke with Walter Cronkite in 1993 after the publication of his memoir. How did you start saying at the end of your broadcast, and that's the way it is?
Well, that was a very contrived sign-off, obviously, and I'm a little embarrassed about it today. Dick Salant, the sainted late Richard Salant, who was president of CBS News when we went to the half hour, hated it and tried to talk me out of it. But being the stubborn Dutchman I am, I clung to it, and it became so much a signature so quickly that I was not inclined to give it up. But what happened was when we went from a half hour to a half hour. I thought we'd have plenty of time. Fool that I was, naive as I was, I thought that doubling our time would give me time to end the piece with the kind of stories I always liked when I worked for the United Press and Scripps Howard. I liked the irony of fate stories, the little one-paragraph stories or two-paragraph stories that you put under an italicized head somewhere in the front page. And there were the little human interest touches. And if I use that kind of story, knowing that sign-off lines were terribly popular in broadcasting and always have worked for people, I thought maybe I could use one if I could find one that I could say as a tagline to either a humorous or a pathetic story. And you can say, and that's the way it is, almost anyway. And that's the way it is, you know, an ironic touch, or a satirical touch, or doubting touch, and that's the way it is, a sad touch, and a regretful touch. And so that's why I devised the line, and it certainly has stuck.
You say you're embarrassed about it now. Why are you embarrassed?
Because I think Dick Salant was right. We didn't get to use those irony of fate stories. Almost from the beginning of the evening news, things were so... There was so much news to cover in the half hour allotted to us, less than that, less subtracting commercials and lead-ins and lead-outs and so forth. There was so much to cover. We never got those irony of fate stories in. As a result, we were loading the broadcast with important news, and I was ending up saying, and that's the way it is, an arrogant line, in a sense.
Right. That's how some people saw it, that you were saying, I've told you what the news is, and that's all there is.
Not only that's all there is, but it's all correct.
Yeah, right.
And as Dick pointed out, we're not telling them all that this, and we make mistakes.
You were the anchor and managing editor of the Evening News. When you became the anchor and managing editor, what were some of the changes you made or tried to make?
Well, I think the most important change was that I insisted on doing the broadcast from the desk where I worked, so there would not be a delay in getting from the newsroom to the broadcast location, the studio. And also, I would be in control throughout the half hour of the broadcast. The reason for that was that I really was the managing editor, and I did not want to put copy on the air that somebody had prepared and handed to me. I wanted to see it off the wires. I wanted to make my own judgment on it before going on the air with it. And that was possible if we were in the newsroom operating. They could hand me the press service copy, the teletypes. Bringing the press service copy could be practically at my elbow. And I could have writers and researchers sitting around the rim of the anchor desk, just as they would on a newspaper. I played it that way.
Well, speaking for myself, if I did a broadcast from my office, instead of hearing what I was talking about, listeners or viewers would just be saying, what a mess. You must have been under a lot of pressure to keep a pretty neat desk if you were broadcasting from it.
Not really. We swept the desk clean about 1.5 minute before going on the air. My motto was, our deadline is when we leave the air. We changed the broadcast right through to the time I signed off. It very seldom ended up precisely as we had planned it in advance. It drove producers and directors and technicians crazy, but that's the way I believed it should be done. There was no reason we had to close out the broadcast before we went on the air. If you've got capable people who can handle it on the microphone, on the cameras, and in the control room, there's no reason why you can't update that broadcast to the very last second.
We're remembering Walter Cronkite. He died Friday at the age of 92. Let's get back to my 1993 interview with Cronkite. Let's talk about what I think for many Americans it was one of your most memorable moments as a broadcaster, and I mean, it was a shocking moment in broadcasting. I'm sure you know what I'm getting at. It was the day Kennedy was shot, and you made the announcement on CBS that he was shot, and then made the announcement that he was dead. How did you end up being the one to go on the air?
Well, I was the one who carried most of the burden of our spontaneous or extemporaneous news coverage in those days. I was the anchorman of the evening news and usually the broadcaster of conventions, elections, things of that kind. So it would not have been unnatural for me to do it. But actually, the fact was that I was in the newsroom preparing the evening news broadcast. I was there right when the wires, the United Press had the beat. Merriman Smith, the White House correspondent for United Press, got the first break, and the bulletin bells rang on the machine. We all gathered around, and there was the news that shots rang out, and today is President Kennedy's motorcade toured the streets of Dallas. Bing, 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 another bulletin. The motorcade is broken up, and it appears that it's on the way to a hospital. President Kennedy may have been hit. And with that, well, we immediately ordered up the air and went on the air. We couldn't get the camera warm immediately. In those days, we didn't keep one warm for those purposes, although after this experience, we did. But they started warming up a camera and moving it into place in the newsroom. Meanwhile, I went into an announce booth and went on the air as a voiceover over a bulletin slide over a soap opera that was on at the time.
When you went on to say that Kennedy was dead, your eyes teared. And that's something that we've seen replayed so many times on, you know, every anniversary of the death. And I mean, it's become one of these historic moments of broadcasting. Were you concerned about getting emotional on the air? Did you try to be as emotionless and stoic as possible? And were you concerned when you realized that your eye was tearing?
Well, I wasn't concerned about my eye tearing. I was concerned about my voice choking and not being able to speak. And that concerned me quite a lot. The tearing didn't matter. I certainly, I didn't really think about it, except the concern that I wouldn't be able to get the words out.
How close did you come to not being able to get them out?
Pretty close, I think. I remember a moment of real terror that I was going to choke up and fall apart, if you said, as it were.
As a journalist and broadcaster, did you think it was acceptable to let some emotion show?
Oh, yes, I think it was then, and I think it is now. I don't think if one happens to be an emotional type and has a little problem with that, perhaps, that there should necessarily try to suppress it. It could be overdone. I mean, if one were so emotional that every story broke him up, that would be unacceptable, obviously. But to have it happen once or twice in a broadcasting career is not that exceptional.
Walter Cronkite, recorded in 1993. He died Friday at the age of 92. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tuohy-Westman, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhivar, John Myers, and John Sheehan. I'm Terry Gross.